The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're reading about the presidential campaign on Twitter or Facebook, or just speaking to others just about anywhere in America right now, you have probably heard or read some version of this sentence. How come the mainstream media isn't covering this scandal, this outrage, these crowds, this candidate, this platform? You fill in the blank. Callum Borchers is a reporter for Washington Post, and he compiled a list of allegedly ignored stories and then published them under this heading. Here are those presidential campaign stories that the media never covers. We wanted to know why there seems to be such a gap between journalists and news consumers about what is being reported on. So we invited him on the show. And Cal, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
So you've come through Twitter as one outlet for public conversation. Which subjects or stories do people say have been ignored?
I think it's a combination of what you just listed. Some of it's the scandals, right? So, and it always depends on which candidate you support, right? So the Trump supporters would tell you, well, how come, you know, you're never covering Benghazi, or you never cover the Hillary email scandal, and then on the reverse, so you might get, say, a Bernie Sanders supporter, and you'll get the complaint, well, how come you're not covering Bernie enough? You know, one of the big complaints during the primary season was you'd be watching cable news coverage of the event, and they would show only some snippet of his speech, or they'd cut away, or then Trump would come on and they'd ditch Bernie. So those were sort of the common complaints that you would get.
But what did you find in your results? Are those stories indeed being covered?
They certainly are being covered. So never is a strong word. And so as I'm combing through Twitter, you know, I'm seeing people say, well, the media never cover such and such. So that's almost always not the case. Degrees are a different conversation. But I think one of the interesting aspects here is that, you know, on social media, the news has been democratized in a way that, you know, makes the front page or the home page a little bit less meaningful, right? So I think, you know, you go back maybe 20 years, let's say, it would have been easier to kind of bury a story on, you know, page C-17, right? And it might not get a whole lot of readership. But, you know, today, if you've got a story online and people are really interested in it, wherever it is on your website, if it's getting a lot of play on Twitter or Facebook, you can still get a lot of traffic to that story. So there's a little bit more power for the readers to decide what is going to be seen and what is not. And I think that's probably a good thing.
I want to go back to that never comment, but if things are being shared from friend to friend, that does limit exposure to certain stories. Is that what social media does?
It certainly does, you know, sort of connected to another timely event. You know, we've had the report since last week from Gizmodo, right, about Facebook trending news topics. And one of the most fascinating follow-ups to that I saw was from the Wall Street Journal this week. They put together a really interesting infographic. It wasn't just about the trending topics, but what they did was they created sort of like make-believe users, right, like a conservative user and a liberal user. And they looked at, you know, what shows up in those people's news feeds. And it was really like parallel universes, you know. So if you're relying on Facebook to get a lot of your news, it can become kind of an echo chamber where, you know, you are being fed news stories either, you know, from Facebook or from, you know, the people who are friends in your network are posting stories that are probably largely things that you agree with, and you may not be getting the full picture of what's going on in the world.
So back to this never idea, a lot of complaints that paid media never covers Bernie's crowds, or the media never covered Ted Cruz's speeches. By your count, that is not true. But could the argument be made that how often these stories are presented contain their own kind of bias?
Yeah, the frequency question, I think that there's a little bit more to that. And I think partly it stems from, especially as we head toward the general election, kind of a long-term disparity between the two leading candidates. So I think that a lot of the folks who feel like Trump is getting a lot of undue scrutiny right now, maybe more so than what Clinton is getting, are perhaps forgetting that, you know, Clinton has been a political figure for, you know, 3 or 4 decades now. There is a lot on her that goes back a long time, whereas this is the first time that Trump has ever run for office. And so a lot of the coverage of him in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s was really on him as either a businessman or an entertainment figure. But it wasn't the sort of critical coverage that you get now because, the stakes were so low, right? And if he engaged in a little bit of hyperbole, what was the harm? It's not like he was running for president or something. Well, guess what? Now he is. So I think in some ways the press is kind of playing catch-up on Trump. And one way that manifests itself is in a lot of intense coverage of him in a short period of time, which I think makes some of his supporters feel like, hey, how come you're piling on my guy? And it feels like maybe Clinton is getting off relatively easy.
Well, actually, a new Vox study shows that the biggest news outlets publish more negative stories about Hillary Clinton than any other presidential candidate, including Trump. Now, it's from January 2015 to April of 2016. So again,
now, Virginia, don't come in with your numbers here and just facts trying to blur the picture.
I know. That really messes things up. But it is interesting about Trump. I mean, he seems to have deflected these stories about his finance or history or conduct that traditional news organizations generally do run on candidates. So do you think that's contributing to the frustration among news consumers who say the news coverage isn't having any effect?
Yeah, I think it's all about the effect, Virginia. I think that's exactly what it is. And you've seen this frustration come out on probably one of the most prominent examples is a program like the Morning Joe show on MSNBC, where they have been accused throughout the campaign of being a little too cozy with Trump. Of course, more recently, they've been feuding with him. So the tide has turned a little bit there. But, their defense all along has been, look, we can't force him to answer these questions. All these questions that you say, well, why don't you ask him about the offensive things he says about, Mexicans or Muslims? Well, we do. We ask him about these things repeatedly, and he finds some way to duck or deflect. It feels like people who don't like Trump won't be satisfied until his campaign collapses. But because the effect hasn't been what you want, doesn't mean that the effort hasn't been good. So, reporters can ask. I mean, it was funny, we had a technology conference here at the Post this week, and I think that our owner, Jeff Bezos, put it well when he said, the voters are the ones who make the decisions in this country, right? So we go out and we do a story on Trump like we did last week about how he posed as his own spokesperson under a fake name, in the 80s and 90s. And, so we'll put that story out there, and it might irk some voters, like, why are you focusing on this thing? And he says, look, we're not telling you what to do with that information, but here it is. This is something that we think you should know about a candidate who wants to hold the highest office in the land. And then it's up to you. And if you're fine with that, if it doesn't trouble you greatly, then go ahead, mm-hmm. vote for him. And nobody's telling you not to. But the answer isn't to provide less information, right? I mean, the answer is to give you all the information that you need to make an educated decision.
You know those stories that the mainstream media just isn't covering during this election cycle? Well, we're speaking with Callum Borchers. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. He composed a list of these allegedly ignored stories and showed how many articles, interviews, and posts had actually been written about them. Is there or are there subjects in this news cycle, especially this election cycle, that you do think has received too much or too little coverage?
I think, as I said, that we're playing a good game of catch-up on it now. But where I think that there was perhaps that shortcoming in that department was early in the campaign. And I think, on the one hand, I think an easy defense for the press would be to say, well, the early coverage of Donald Trump, for instance, was, largely critical. People were pointing out all the sort of inflammatory things that he said. So how could you, accuse the press of not being tough enough on him? But I think that the flip side to that argument is that because we were fixated on those things and because many of us didn't ever imagine that he would get as far as he has, there wasn't the kind of deep probing into his business record or his, his relationships, with women, right? The New York Times had that big in-depth story mm-hmm. on Sunday about right. how he's interacted with women over the years. We weren't doing that type of reporting early in the campaign because he wasn't really considered a real contender. So I think if there's a deficiency to reflect on, it might be that. It might be, we should have started that earlier in the cycle and perhaps not allowed ourselves to be distracted by, the latest offensive thing out of his mouth.
It is funny that, people are complaining, but there's actually an accusation there of deliberately ignoring topics. So there's this sense of defensiveness, I guess. You know, you're showing that people, these are the stories we did indeed cover, and a lot of people have reacted to that by saying, you know, stop grandstanding. Should journalists feel the need to defend their coverage, or should they just let it be? I mean, they're never going to be able to control the way that people take it. They're going to be unhappy no matter what gets covered and how often.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something that I think about a lot, and I'm sure that, you know, journalists think about too, right? Is, you know, should you just sort of let the work stand alone, or do you need to kind of come out and explain? And so back to that that Times example, right? We, in this case, we saw the reporters get out this week and be very visible in defending their work. And I think that increasingly in this cycle anyway, and it may just be a function of how hostile the Trump campaign in particular has been toward the press, although Clinton's not super friendly either, but I think that there is an increasing sense that, you know, we do need to at times get out and sort of explain how we do our news gathering and kind of explain, you know, here's the information we collected and here's how it ended up in print. You know, one of the sort of efforts of transparency that I've, you know, been a fan of is posting full interview transcripts. And that's something we've seen more of. I think that, you know, our Chris Elizer had a post about that a while ago. It's becoming, you know, the transcript campaign. You know, so Trump comes in and he sits with the editorial board of the Washington Post, and we publish the whole transcript of the interview, or he does a big long foreign policy interview with the New York Times, and they publish the entire transcript of the interview. And you know, we realize that most voters won't take the time to read through the whole thing, but if you're interested, you can. And if you think that we're just sort of cherry picking, you know, the juiciest quotes, or we're, you know, we're taking things out of context, well, here it is. You know, go back, read the whole thing for yourself, and you can be the judge. And I think that's something that is a very good step.
Callum Borchers with The Washington Post, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks, Virginia.
Now, you can check out his list of articles that the media supposedly never covers. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last fall, the AIDS Health Foundation launched a billboard campaign in Los Angeles linking mobile dating apps like Tinder and Grindr to the spread of STDs and offering free screenings. In a statement, the foundation charged that location-based apps are making casual sex as easily available as ordering a pizza and are becoming, quote, a digital bathhouse for millennials where the next encounter can be just a few feet away along with an STD. A startup called Mately is banking that online daters will pay a premium to know the sexual history of their potential hookups and be willing to share their status online as well. Stephen Blum wrote about the Mately app for Broadly. And Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tinder and Grindr are both apps to find people to hook up with close by at any given moment. Now, we're in a kind of a rural area where they're used less. So tell us, how does that initial communication begin?
Yes, it's usually pretty casual. It's definitely not like trading STD statuses right off the bat. I mean, I don't think most interactions are like that. I would say with Grindr, it's sort of almost like a gay Facebook in some ways, because people will just sort of idly chat on it, maybe not even looking for a hookup. But Tinder, of course, is more straight people and gay people, and I would say that it has the reputation as a hookup app. So sex is always sort of on the table.
So you said STD queries rarely come up. So what is Mately offering that can help in this direction?
Well, so instead of saying something like, are you tested, and then having to trust that the other person is not lying about their results, Mately will actually allow you to send a link to your STD testing results so that people will be able to see online what STDs you've recently been tested for. And then they also will allow you to display a badge, a Mately badge on your profile that will show that you are a Mately member and that you are sort of all up to date on your STD testing.
So these are monthly tests for gonorrhea, chlamydia, herpes, syphilis, hepatitis A, B, C, early detection of HIV. How much does this cost?
So I talked to the Mately founder, Brandon Greenberg, and he is basically setting up a subscription that will cost $30 a month. Mm-hmm. And he said that this is about on par with what many gay men spend on haircuts or gym memberships.
So he's banking on them spending that money to make sure that the STD status of their potential hookup is known.
Exactly. He thinks that this is about, you know, this is a reasonable cost. But I asked him about whether or not he hoped that one day a health insurance company might be able to pay for this. And that's part of his plan. So he's hopeful that this will someday be covered by insurance.
Well, I mentioned that billboard campaign at the beginning, and Grindr and Tinder both reacted swiftly to that. In fact, Tinder's lawyer accused the foundation of unprovoked and wholly unsubstantial accusations to damage their reputation and to encourage testing by the AIDS Health Foundation. Is there any evidence connecting dating apps to high-risk behavior or to STDs?
There is, I don't believe, any study that connects those two things, but definitely there are exploding rates of syphilis in California, where I live, and other STDs. So that's part of why Mately believes that they are well-positioned in the marketplace to provide more transparency about whether or not people have actually been tested for these STDs.
And transparency means having access to somebody else's STD testing history. But you make the point that sharing that opens up a Pandora's box for privacy issues. What are some of those concerns, and then how does Mately propose to deal with them?
So the idea is that if you are a Mately member, you get to look at someone's profile for an unlimited amount of time. But if you aren't a Mately member, you get about 5 or 10 seconds, I guess, to look at the results. So this would be sort of like a Snapchat type scenario. Snapchat is this app where you can share things and you can only look at them for a short period of time. But the risk is that someone will shame someone for having an STD or for having HIV, and that someone will share their link with other friends. But the way that he hopes to protect against this is that the name itself is not listed on the website. It's actually a code number. So you'd have to be able to know how the code correlates with someone's name.
This certainly does make a lot of sense in helping to prevent the spread of STDs. But it does bring up this issue that the gay community and people with herpes, for example, have been dealing with for a long time. And it's that stigmatization of people with STDs. Is there a potential here with Mately of kind of, you know, creating a dating hierarchy, those who are clean, disease-free, and those who aren't?
So that's exactly what I thought when I first heard about Mately. I was very suspicious and skeptical because I know from my own experience as well that people serosort on Grindr. It's basically just choosing partners who they believe don't have HIV based on whatever available information that they have. I sort of, when I first heard about this, I thought this is just going to be another way to sort of make disease-free people at the top of the dating hierarchy. And I think that that could be harmful, especially in regards to stigmatizing people who do have HIV. But the more that I talked to Brandon Greenberg, the more it seemed like he is just interested in transparency for transparency's sake. He said, of course, HIV-positive people are welcome on the platform, and he hopes that they will join and show that they are up to date on all their other STD testing. And also, you know, if they are confirmed as HIV, then that is a way to say, I am tested and I'm safe. I'm a safe bet.
Well, Mately is proposing building a lab, and they would have to have relationships with local pharmacies, according to the business model. They're now conducting an Indiegogo campaign to launch to do that. Do you think it's likely they're going to pull it off?
I'm not quite sure. The problem is that they've raised about $4,000, but they have a $500,000 goal, which is pretty ambitious. They have 2 months to reach that goal on Indiegogo, but I'm not quite sure how successful they're going to be. I think that this sort of radical transparency is definitely something that we might be moving towards as a society, but I'm not quite sure if people are ready for it just yet.
Stephen Blum, thank you for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you so much.
You can read Stephen's article from Broadly. It's called "This New App Will Tell You If Your Tinder Date Has an STD." There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The life of a U.S. president is a guarded one. From the moment they are elected to the hour of their death, they get 24/7 Secret Service protection. Access is restricted for their safety, but it also limits the public from seeing what their real life is like behind the scenes. The White House presidential photographer gives us a glimpse.
Sousa can't know when something historic will happen, so he shoots it all. It's blanket coverage that takes some getting used to.
I think sometime early in the administration, I had a conversation with the president. I was taking so many pictures every day, and he sort of asked me about it, and I explained it to him. I'm going to document every meeting that you have. It's for history.
That's narrator Morgan Freeman talking with Pete Sousa, who is President Obama's chief official White House photographer, from a 2010 documentary called The President's Photographer. We wanted to learn more about the history of following the president with a camera. So we're turning to Michael Martinez. He's a recovering photojournalist who now teaches at the University of Tennessee. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Great, thank you.
Who was the first official presidential photographer?
Oh, that's a tough one. It depends on how you define it. Abbey Rowe was the first one that was able to photograph in presidential activities. And then Cecil Stoughton was President Kennedy's photographer. But the first one that was hired specifically to be a presidential photographer was Yoichi Okamoto, who was LBJ's presidential photographer. And he was hired, specifically for that role.
Are there any photos that Abbey Rowe or Cecil Stoughton took that we might recognize?
Probably the most iconic photograph of any presidential photographer would be the one Cecil Stoughton photographed of LBJ being sworn in. And he was the only one there. And if it weren't for him, there would be no record of that. And it was him working his way into that plane when LBJ flew from Dallas back to D.C.
Oh, right, that photo of him being sworn in and Jackie Kennedy's at his side, just looking so distraught. What a picture.
Right.
When did the official presidential photographer then become the norm?
I would say LBJ. Cecil Stoughton was still part of the military service, that his duty was to photograph some of Kennedy's activities, and ultimately he did stay on a little bit during LBJ's term. But Okamoto was the first one that actually was hired to be a full-time 24/7 presidential photographer.
And that was by LBJ?
Yes.
Interesting, because we know that LBJ had tapes of him, every conversation that he had on the telephone and in his office. Was he especially, preoccupied with the idea of documenting his presidency?
I think a little bit. I think it was more Okamoto pushing. He liked what Okamoto had done early on when he photographed LBJ in Germany on one of his vice presidential trips. Oki was not working for the White House at all. He was working for one of the foreign services.
USAID, I think.
Right, exactly. And he invited Oki to come and work as his documentary photographer. Oki predicated accepting the position that he had access to him from before he started his day till after he ended the day. He didn't want to just be summoned in on and off. You know, he wanted to be there whenever he needed to be there. He wanted to be there 24/7.
So fast forward to now, in the age of digital photography and social media, has that changed the way that White House photographers do their job?
I don't think it's changed the way that they photograph, but I think it's changed the way that the images are delivered. It used to be, prior to the internet, and prior presidents, before President Obama, they would go through a wire service and be distributed to newspapers and magazines that way. And now they go straight to the internet. And, you know, news organizations can pick them up, but the public can see them directly.
Are all photos taken by the White House photographer public domain?
Well, ultimately, they're public domain. But what they do, for example, Pete Sousa, he posts a selection of the day's activities. You know, you can't just go say, hey, I want to see all however many you shot on that day. But ultimately, down the road, once they're out of office and they're archived, you know, there's well, you have to go through a Freedom of Information Act request, but ultimately you can get access to whatever has been shot.
Well, I noticed last year, I think it was last summer, photos taken inside of the White House on 9/11 were released.
Yes.
For the first time. So is there a kind of sensitivity around some photos? They may not release them?
Interestingly enough, the Presidential Records Act makes it to the point to where if you want to request some photographs to be able to see them, you have to submit a Freedom of Information Act request.
Mm-hmm.
And then a president whose office that you're trying to see the records of has say whether they're released or not. And now, having said that, I mean, that's how these recent 9/11 photographs were released, is that somebody asked for them.
I'm talking with Michael Martinez about the history of presidential photographers and how that job of following the president with a camera has evolved over the years. Well, I'm thinking about FDR. We never saw photographs of him in a wheelchair. You know, we certainly didn't see some of the activities in JFK's White House. But we did see some photos that others might consider compromising of LBJ.
Sure.
Can the president veto shots, in effect, that they don't like?
Well, up until the Presidential Records Act came into play, no. If you go to the presidential libraries and do research, literally there are notebooks showing from day one, from the inauguration day, you know, throughout his presidency, of contact sheets. And you can look through them. Once the Presidential Records Act was instituted, then it started restricting them as far as some are released and some are not.
So do they get unlimited access to the president?
That will vary by president. President Ford was very open with David Hume Kinnerly, and he got... I think if I remember correctly, there's only a couple of instances that had to deal with personnel matters that David didn't have access to. But other than that, from the records that I've been able to find, he virtually had unlimited access. Others are more restrictive, and it really is up to the president as to how much, you know, they'll let the photographer around them.
Yeah, I wonder about, you know, top secret clearance, or what kind of state secrets they might be privy to if they're taking photographs.
Well, it's interesting. Very specifically, for example, I was speaking with David Valdez, who was President George H.W. Bush's photographer, and he said he was summoned to the Oval Office when they were launching the Gulf War.
Hmm.
You know, presidents want those moments recorded oftentimes.
Well, that makes me wonder if we're getting a true picture insight into the presidency. It sounds like there's some curation going on here about what they want recorded.
Well, it depends on the president and how much they understand or really want documentation. Most of them do. You know, some of them, President Nixon, for example, was very, hands-on management and was concerned about his image much more so than some of the other presidents. And as I mentioned, LBJ, Okamoto said, I want unlimited access. Now, having said that, LBJ was very concerned about his image, but Okamoto was able to get into moments where, you know, he wasn't kicked out at all.
Even when he was in the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but I'm thinking with Nixon, I mean, that iconic photo of Nixon and Elvis in the White House when Elvis, I guess, kind of popped in.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they think, oh, this is a photo op. We can take a photograph of this.
Right, right.
Well, okay, so you're talking about how dependent it is on the president, what kind of access they get. But mm-hmm. Let's talk about Pete Sousa, who is somebody that, you know, photojournalists say he's not a photojournalist. He's more of an event photographer. He's looking for the best shot, not mm-hmm. the real shot.
Well, you know, his background is in photojournalism. He worked for newspapers prior to become the presidential photographer. What's interesting is I consider him a documentary photographer. He's documenting the presidency. I know there has been some criticism about him getting exclusive access where other members of the press are not able to go, and where they maybe should be able to participate.
Like where?
There's a couple of them. One was when President Obama visited a civil rights museum and sat in a bus that Rosa Parks rode in,
mm-hmm.
and Pete Sousa was the only one that was there photographing that. And there was another one. It was a meeting with the Dalai Lama, I believe it was, where, again, Pete Sousa was the only one that had access. And members of the media were arguing that, you know, those are events that a tight pool, if nothing else, should be able to be present.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like a really demanding job. You have to be on call all the time, you know, you serve at the president's pleasure. Would you want the job?
I'd love to have the job.
Really? Why?
To be able to see the person behind the scenes, to see the man that occupies the office, and be able to record it for posterity, I think that would be a great opportunity.
Michael, thank you for speaking with us.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you.
Michael Martinez, he is a former photojournalist, now assistant professor at the School of Journalism and Electronic Media at the University of Tennessee. Now, we do have links to read more and see more pictures from the White House Photography Office. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Film studios all have signature logos to start off their movies. Paramount's, that ring of stars over a snow-capped peak, is the oldest surviving Hollywood film logo. Pixar shows an animated desk lamp that hops into the frame and becomes the letter I in its name. Producer Nate DeMeo from the podcast The Memory Palace brings us the history of MGM's roaring logo.
They took a lion cub from the Nubian desert, and they put him in the movies. They called him Jackie, trained him to sit and come on command, to rear up, to look fierce but not be fierce. They kept him well fed so he wouldn't eat anyone. And they made Jackie chase Tarzan through the jungles of the Los Angeles Arboretum, menace Jane from the edge of the shallow concrete pond dressed with palm fronds and ferns, around the corner from the ersatz suburbs on the MGM backlot, where he scampered about for the cameras until some director called cut and had sufficient footage to make it appear that Jackie was chasing Laurel and or Hardy. In some morning in 1927, he was led out of his cage, led through the lot where the showgirls in sequins shuffled off to their 7:15 call, walked amidst extras in togas and cowboy hats, and was led to a soundstage, where he hopped up on two crates, one for his back paws, one for his front paws, looked into the camera, leaned into a microphone, and roared. That roar would be heard hundreds of times a day, at thousands of movie theaters across the movie mad world. It was the late 1920s, and the movies were it. They were the thing you did. Everyone. Every demographic. Everywhere. There were 20,000 theaters in the U.S. alone. There were vast movie palaces with velvet curtains and gilt ceilings, balconies and orchestras and loges and tuxedoed ushers in every big city. And there were silver screens and folding chairs and storefronts and old vaudeville halls in just about every hill and holler. A nickel, a dime, for a feature or two, a newsreel, shorts, cartoons, a couple of coins for a whole evening's entertainment, for a whole afternoon's childcare. And now with sound. There was sound now. Broadway melodies, thundering cavalry, cannonades, tap shoes, sighing lovers, captured forever, like Jackie, roaring. At the beginning of every MGM picture, 10 seconds in time, captured forever. and relived again and again and again, duplicated, spliced onto reel after reel after reel, familiar to just about every man, woman, and child in the United States and beyond for decades. Officially, Jackie was Leo. That's the MGM line's name. It's nom de marketing. Jackie was the second Leo. The first was named Slats. And he didn't roar. It was the silent era, so he just kind of looked around. But Jackie roared. And people loved him for it. The idea was rock solid. People love Leo. And people love planes. It was the summer of 1927. Lindbergh had landed in Paris in May. Aviators were in the papers all the time. New speed records, endurance records, altitude records. X guy flew from X place to Y place for the first time. So it's July or August, and someone at the publicity office at MGM says, "What if we put Leo in a plane?" And it was basically the best idea anyone had ever heard. He'd be the first animal, non-human category, to fly non-stop cross-country. The publicity would be amazing. So they found a pilot, a famous one, who'd just come in second in a race from California to Honolulu, which was the kind of thing that could make you famous in 1927. They found a plane, which was the same model as Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis, and they tricked it out, put in state-of-the-art navigation systems, and built a special cage for Jackie. He wouldn't be able to turn around, because any shift in weight could disrupt the flight. But he could handle it for the 20 hours or so it would take to go from San Diego to New York. Not that they asked Jackie. And the press and the public ate it up and descended upon a Southern California airfield to wish their beloved Leo bon voyage. And the voyage was going totally bon until they flew over Arizona. And the famous pilot dipped down to wave to a relative as he passed near her house and couldn't regain altitude. And he clipped a tree. And the plane went down in the middle of the Arizona desert. Jackie survived. You can breathe easy. The plane broke up, but the cage remained intact. And the famous pilot left him some sandwiches and water. And 4 days later, he came back with some cowboys and found Jackie hungry but healthy. It was a bad look for MGM, nearly killing its mascot. But there is no bad publicity, right? And so Leo the Lion became Leo the Lucky, and Jackie went on tour. No plane this time. He was driven in a custom-made 24-foot-long car, outfitted with a gilded cage with room to turn around. He traveled in a 3-car caravan with a 54-note circus calliope, and a trainer, and a manager, and valets, who were there, they said, to attend to his every need. He ate fine cuts of fine meat. He wanted for nothing, they said. They knew they had nearly killed him in that plane crash, and they were going to do right by him from here on out. Right by him, it seems, was taking him on a 40,000-mile journey through 38 states for 3 years straight. Right by him, it seems, was riding in an open cage on state roads at speeds, though safe, where not speeds a lion was born to travel. Right by him, it seems, were stops in 1,418 cities and towns, where he did things he was not born to do. There was nothing instinctual, nothing lion-like, nothing that had been encoded in his DNA by generations upon generations of natural selection about being made to roar on command, to not roar despite his desires, to offer his big paw to small-town bigwigs, to entertain at orphanages, to attend ribbon cuttings, to bring an odd joy to thousands upon thousands of human beings who flocked to town squares and village greens to see this celebrity from the silver screen. While he sat like a dog, when he was not a dog, bred to want human companionship, to want to be pet, to be somehow pleased by pleasing people. I'm sure some of these people were cruel, because they were people. I don't trust a boy in a Michigan roadside in 1929, 1930, not to test his arm and test what happens when you hit the only lion you were ever going to see in your town, the rock. And I'm sure there were times when the nights were too cold, when the crosswinds were too strong on some county road out of Eau Claire or Coeur d'Alene, when he had to sit too long while the mayor of Waxahachie or Carpinteria asked for a retake of his big photo op with the famous Leo because he was sure he'd blinked. But he was well-fed and well-cared for. His handlers were kind, within limits, historical and scientific. He would have been bad for business otherwise. He spent his retirement at the Philadelphia Zoo, where he died pretty young of a bad heart. There have been far worse lives led by African lions in North America. There were other Leos after Jackie, each made to do things they weren't born to do. But Jackie is still captured forever. You can see him at the beginning of the old movies. Catch him on TV now and then. You can search him on YouTube. That's Jackie in sepia tone at the start of The Wizard of Oz. And it's nice to see him there. But see him too. In a cage by the wreckage of a single-engine monoplane in the middle of the Arizona desert. And I don't ask you to ignore the bars. See the bars. For he was captured forever. But see him there in the desert. Alert for predators. Scanning the horizon and the scrub brush for movement, for prey. Breathing desert air. Looking out at the stars, at the low rolling hills. No streetlights. No Hollywood sign. Doing what he was born to do.
And that story came to us from producer Nate DeMeo and the podcast The Memory Palace. You'll find a link to hear more stories from The Memory Palace at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some of your time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to post on social media, or to email to friends. And please let us know what you are curious about, the stories and sources that you're finding interesting, or what is scratching at your sense of wonder. We find the best ideas bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to keep on sharing them with Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.